Okay, I give the floor to Suzanne.
So today's paper is discussing the Disclosure Initiative's standards level review of disclosures project, and it's our proposal for the initial phase. Purpose of the discussion is to get the board's view on the proposed approach and timing of the project. Some of the specific issues we want to cover today include the scope, approach, and timing of the initial phase, content form and due process of a drafting guide for the IASB's internal use, and a decision point after the initial phase is complete. Our agenda is, number one, objective and output of the project, number two, some issues with our current disclosure requirements, three, a proposed approach for the initial phase of the project, four, proposed content of the drafting guide, and five, after the initial phase is complete, what next? The objective and output. The objective of the project is to enable the ISB to write better disclosure requirements. To achieve this objective, the ISB will develop a drafting guide for its internal use and use this guide for writing future disclosure requirements and amending disclosure requirements and current standards. Some issues that have been identified with our current drafting. Some specific standards are often described as contributing to disclosure overload. Those big four, IFRS 2, IFRS 3, IFRS 7, and IAS 19. There's also specific issues about the way we write disclosure that either we have looked at as problematic or have been drawn to our attention. Some examples are overly prescriptive language, such as the use of at a minimum, you must, you should, within the current requirements. And the other issue could be the absence of clear objectives within each standard, which explain what might be disclosed and why. We think that the development of a drafting guide for use by the ISB would be helpful with these.
Can we ask questions as we're going along?
Sure.
I'm just curious, Susan. I may be at the other end of the spectrum on this issue, but when something is material, I have no concern with the phrase at a minimum.
Right.
So if it's in material, obviously it doesn't apply. When something is material, at a minimum, I would like to see the following elements, let's say, disclosed a note. So I don't find that overly prescriptive. In fact, I find that when note disclosure requirements aren't written prescriptively, I get a lot of boilerplate, I get a lot of non-comparable and inconsistent information.
So I think the term overly prescriptive is overly prescriptive excluding materiality. So if we're just being overly prescriptive in general. But now that we have clarified materiality, material practice statement, hopefully the outcome is that if it's material, you disclose it, whether it's at a minimum, whether there's a prescriptive language around it.
Right.
If it's material, you disclose it.
So, for example, a good example of this is when we were having the debate on the revenue recognition project, and we said, when we were talking about elements of revenue that we thought would be useful for disclosure, we stated an objective, and then we listed a number of things that we thought could meet that objective. But again, my preference there would have been, at a minimum, disclose, you know, revenue by these various guideposts, as opposed to these might help you meet your objective. In which case, one company might give product line revenue, another company may give it geographically, and another company may not give anything at all and just rely on the segment data.
Yeah.
So I actually think that it's important that we are consistent in the use of this phrase, and I actually do believe that standard setters, it's incumbent upon standard setters to be prescriptive. Hence, you don't really get what investors are looking for.
We do have to be careful. I mean, I've had multiple experiences as a preparer where the audit firms have come and says, it says at a minimum an entity shall disclose, and mm-hmm. that means regardless of whether it's material. So that's the point that we need to be very careful about.
Well, I think they're misinterpreting.
Now, I agree, absolutely, but because we haven't explicitly said, I mean, you may well say, and it's correct to say,
right,
the standard is written for material disclosures only, but because it doesn't say that directly in the paragraph, you know, we've had practical problems.
Fair enough.
And I think we put these as examples of a starting point for us to go look at some of these areas and see what clarifications could be added or not, or if there really is a problem. They, you know, there's things that I think are good starting points. I think that's sort of why we put this list together.
Okay.
Can I?
Yeah, we have none of there were other people. Gary?
Yeah, thank you. And, I absolutely support come up with a drafting guide. And, but Pat does make a good point. If it if something really is material, I mean, at a minimum, there's degrees of material. There's, it just happens to be a big number, but not particularly controversial, versus you really need to know something. And I think we got to start parsing, you know, how you would apply that in different circumstances. The fact that something's big, there's a presumption there'll be some information about it, but it might not be controversial or volatile or something, and therefore you don't need too much. And the second dash in here about absence of clear objectives is, you know, we've talked about that more than once in the board advisors meetings, and I think we need to give some thought on that, because if they're going to come back as the objectives are to predict future cash flows, understand changes in the account, well, we might as well, like, that's just boilerplate. That doesn't give you much. I think that needs to be developed. What, you know, how do you even come up with your objectives, you know, presumably, yes, in this case, for disclosure, and a really detailed thought process, because I start to see it becoming boilerplate and the things coming through now, and that doesn't serve the purpose either. Now, are we going to internally write this stuff? There's a lot of stuff you get in bookstores, how to do good business writing and effective report writing and stuff. What's your plan to actually write this thing?
To write the drafting guide?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there in the public domain.
So we're wide open to taking in good advice from other places. And so we have a piece of the principles of disclosure discussion paper that talks about drafting, potential redrafting, and guidelines. And so there's a section in there that we put it out for comment, people can respond to, and we're eager to get feedback on that. So we've got some sample sort of redrafting and writing and some ideas around writing clear objectives, as well as just writing clearly in general. Ways to introduce, you know, tables, graphs, visualizations that aren't necessarily going to be mandatory guidance, but we've looked to external sources and brought that in. And so part of, you know, the answer to that is there's sections in the principal disclosure discussion paper that we'll get comments back on and feedback on.
Now, are you, even though this is for an internal use, are we going to expose this, you know, or what's your staff's thinking?
Can we get to that?
Okay.
As we go
if
through,
it's coming,
is that okay?
Fine. Okay.
To
that's
to
not
delay
fine. If it's coming
first.
Later, I just
it is. We definitely will talk about that.
You mentioned about the list and auditors requiring people to disclose everything on the list. Do you not think that clarification and materiality will solve that? And why do we need to go the next step of removing the must and the should?
I would hope that the materiality clarifications will resolve that, I agree.
So therefore...
I also think we shouldn't leave any doubt whatsoever.
No. Yeah. But then changing the must and the should into a consider and think about, I think is going way too far.
I agree with that. I think those give a free option not to be disclosures. And
right.
I
just want to make sure that we weren't going to propose
certainly
that.
On the same page on that one.
And this is a discussion point at the beginning, so I think the question would be asked, should we, and have a debate about that.
Who are we asking the question?
You two. The board. Sorry. So it would be, part of this process would be to ask the board whether we should go through standards.
Are we asking it now or sometime
in
the future?
I would envisage we ask, this is about the approach and what we would look at. I think it is a good point for discussion, because I think we have had feedback at the way that we, you know, how prescriptive should the disclosure requirements should be, and I think that's a very good point for debate, and I think it's a debate that the board should have as to which way they want to go.
I'm not so ready to just throw away this discussion, this suggestion so clear, so early on, because I do remember we have discussed this a couple of times, and there was an idea that the prescriptiveness of the language in the disclosures led people to disclose immaterial information. So bunch of shredders. Just thinking that just issuing a materiality practice statement that will solve the issue. Rego?
Now, among these three words, the only one I never like, object to fact, is at minimum. And shall and must is okay. But I think we must have a common understanding. Even we use shall and must, it's still subject to materiality judgment. And also, it's related to industrial judgment. For example, we say that you have to disclose inventory. The bank, no inventory. And so in my view, we must have common understanding, even we use must and shall. Does not mean you must disclose, as I say, the subject to materiality and subject to industrial judgment. At the minimum, Pat said, it's good terms, he would like use more. But if we combine materiality judgment together with at minimum, I don't feel it is necessary to have this word. For example, if our revenue standards, all IS1, clearly say that you must disclose separately the sales tax, let's assume. And incidentally, in a country, in a particular industry, for some reasons, government exempt sales tax. Do we want them to disclose sales tax? No, or very minimal amount. It looks like so funny, So at minimum, the term, as I say, I always strongly against to use it. If we already have must and shall.
No.
Weighing in with a view similar to the one that you expressed, Hans, I hear the caution from Pat and Steve, but we had a problem, and I don't think we can count on the IS1 amendment from a year ago to have fixed it once and for all. I think we have to be consistent in our messaging and not let very rigid language continue to accrete, so that's seen as in conflict with the message we're trying to send elsewhere. Maybe the language is prescriptive, we can have a discussion about it, whether it's overly prescriptive. I think we should have a discussion on this point, but when I think back to the examples that we got, I think it was from New Zealand, about you start the other way, here's the objective, and I think we were talking about language along the lines of normally in order to achieve this an entity would, something along those lines. And that kind of parses between the two, but I hear the caution about throwing these away, but I don't want to I don't want to back off of challenging ourselves to be consistent with the messages.
All
from
these things
year.
Are coming back to us detailed. I wouldn't want to also box in the staff right now with our preferences.
The other point there is that is in the chapter that the New Zealand Status Board has written for the discussion paper, and I think we should maybe get quite a good direction from that feedback, make sure the questions get some feedback on that. It's almost how do you introduce a requirement, how do you require a requirement, if for want of a better word, and I think that's the point we're discussing here, so we can get feedback there and then come back to the board.
I certainly think having a drafting guide would be helpful, make us consistent if nothing else, which is always a good thing. I think I do worry a little bit, though, as I've said at previous meetings, about going too far the other way, because we don't yet know if that's going to work. And I think we all think, we're sitting here with preparers who have got the best objective of communicating, and we're in a perfect world. What would that result in? And that might be different to what the reality might be when we're dealing with preparers who might have good intentions but not very experienced staff, not deep teams that can apply judgment well, and where the enforcement might not be perfect. So I think we need to be a little bit cautious. I think I'm a little bit with Pat and Steve. I think maybe there's a sort of halfway between what we've written in the past and sometimes what we seem to be talking about here, which would be that if we're more clear with the objectives and we've written the objectives in a way that's more meaningful, not just allow us to predict future cash flows, but something more and the context, that then if you've got through that as your, and it's clear and everybody reads it in the right way, which is part of the IS1 materiality package, if you've got the context of that objective so that you know it's only where you need to provide information in order to meet that objective, maybe there will be circumstances, although not all of the time, where it's clear that there's certain things that you would definitely want if you need it to meet the objective. And if we can encourage ourselves to write in a more structured way and encourage people to think about it as going through the objective, and then the conclusion of that objective tells you whether or not you sort of pass go and whether you keep reading, then maybe we can still have a place for minimum and must and shall, but it would be in a narrower set and in a clearer context. But I do worry that I've talked to an awful lot of people who still think this whole project's about cutting disclosures down, not improving communication, and I just worry about handing very loose language to people where they think that's our objective when I don't think it is.
Okay.
So to summarize, you know, hitting on going back to the overly prescriptive language before I move on, is just we were thinking of it, and we can come back to this in the next slide or two, as a starting point to look at where that language is used in the standards and see what we think, see it in context, as opposed to just eliminating it, just to clarify. So on slide 9 now, we've sort of mapped out the initial a view of the initial phase. Again, this is for your input. It's to develop and test a drafting guide, which includes, you know, on the three left boxes, if you will, gather, you know, the feedback on two particular fronts from the principal's disclosure discussion paper, which, again, as we've discussed, includes a proposed structure of the objectives for the notes, making that clear, and a couple of different examples in there, as well as proposed redrafting of some specific requirements. Again, this comes from the New Zealand paper. Then there's the staff analysis of current disclosure requirements, and again, that going back to the previous slide, could be looking at some of these language issues and just as a starting point to look at them and see what the context is and whether it's working or not. And then monitoring the work of others, in particular, obviously the FASB and their approach, which includes a specific disclosure framework, and you can work the SEC is doing as well, and other standard setters as well.
The SEC is doing some work as well?
They're doing a disclosure initiative as well, you know, and obviously because it kind of expands on what the FASB is doing because it's for the publicly traded companies there, so in the U.S. And then we would test the drafting guide, and we can test it one of two ways or both ways, targeting individual standards and targeting specific issues that we identify in the previous boxes.
What do you mean by specific issues? Are they cost-cutting issues, or you want to go directly
great point for clarification. I think what we have been thinking so far is some of the language issues, and so other issues can come up as we start, you know, continue and do research.
We'd be looking at all the shall or should or.
Yes, or so, you know, is there duplication, or are there things where there's inconsistencies? You know, one of my colleagues on the team has done amazing work on literally looking through standards for inconsistencies, duplicate requirements, as well as obviously the language issues. And we didn't put every example that we've actually looked at as a team in here, but there's other issues, again, we can talk about more. So slide 10, you know, just the steps is develop a drafting guide. We'll talk about the content in a couple slides later. Test it against this targeted standard and or issue. Finalize the drafting guide, and then issue exposure drafts of standards with amended disclosure requirements based on the work of that guide. So you can see that the principal's disclosure discussion paper feedback feeds into the drafting guide, whether we choose targeted standards or targeted issues. And these, again, are just examples. And then that would feed into actual changes to disclosure requirements in existing standards is the punchline there. Slide 11 just literally is sort of a sense of timing, as well as that it's running in parallel, if you will, slightly behind the principles of discussion disclosure paper and getting feedback from that. But the principles of discussion disclosure paper may result in proposed revisions of general disclosure or a new standard of IAS 1 or a new general disclosure standard, and the initial phase of the review of standards project down below, what we just described is sort of running alongside.
With this, I'm back on slide 10.
Yes.
And looking at the targeted standard or targeted issue, I know you've just given an example. But point three at the top.
Yep.
Are we going to sort of get the market to begin expecting that we're going to review all standards? Or, you know, how do we handle this?
It's expectation.
Yeah.
Yes. So we'll get to that at the end. Is it okay again to defer? We will get to that, I promise, okay. Because it's a very important question. All right, let's moving on to the drafting guide potential content itself on slide 13. And at a high level, we right now are suggesting that it comprise three things: guidelines, processes, and tools. So it's bigger than just a document. It's a whole approach. So it's a guide to drafting better improved requirements. So guidelines are on how to write better, reflecting the problems and issues we've identified, again, either in individual standards or by individual issues. Use of language, again, you know, without pushing the hot button of overly prescriptive, you know, but use of language is one approach. We got feedback last week, as some of you know, from ASAF, and also we've gotten feedback from FASB and spoken with them about the content of guidelines. You know, sort of, where does it begin? Does it begin at, how do we decide if a disclosure is needed? You know, sort of stepping all the way back, which is sort of what the FASB disclosure framework does, and then going into specific content items, what things should we look for in terms of whether what to include in a disclosure or not for a specific issue. And so it's, we've gotten great feedback already and expect to continue to get feedback and you know, obviously welcome your input as well. Processes around applying the guidelines, and some of the things we have in mind is identifying internally, again this is internal, where and how to begin discussion around disclosure for specific issues, perhaps earlier in or along the way, all along the way of the due process for a new standard or reopening of an existing standard. You know, having the XBRL team involved, you know, early on to see what this means in terms of digital reporting and just sort of having the disclosure discussions where they should best be placed and how we can enhance that whole part of the process. And tools that would help with implementing the guidelines and the processes, improve technology tools to aid us in seeing existing disclosures. The map of, if you will, of what we've already got out there as disclosure requirements, so as we write new ones, for example, we're not accidentally duplicating or being inconsistent, and you know, there might be tools that will help us do that, improve how we do that, beyond just keyword searches, which are effective but limited. So
can I just add, just reiterate the point you made, what ASAF raised, which I thought was a good point, was to what extent should this guide bridge the gap between what's in the conceptual framework and, you know, identifying what should be a disclosure requirement, what is relevant information, and should guide you through that process. And that mirrors, in effect, what the FASB has done with their proposal on their disclosure framework. So I think I just wanted to draw that out because it's not particularly that clear there, but I do want to put it in your minds to what extent should it cover that point.
Can I just ask one more question?
Yeah, sure.
And in this drafting guide, you raised the point which led me to think about tools that are now built into, for example, Microsoft Office Suite. Are you thinking about ultimately a product that would be created in an electronic environment where, you know, you're tasked to write a note disclosure on a particular element and you would draw or pull down information from, you know, the literature and then and other sources to actually write that more effectively? It would have the do's and the don'ts more or less kind of built in, the artificial intelligence there for you? Is that, or are we still going to live in this kind of environment where?
Ideally in an electronic environment, you know, I think we've discussed in many other times in here and externally about the wave of the future and you know, I come with a personal bias about this is a knowledge management sort of world that we're in, and so the tools and best practices out there around knowledge management could likely be useful to us and help us.
Okay.
The other thing we talked about was providing a way to see the disclosures together, all the disclosures together. Now, the taxonomy provides that, but perhaps not in a user-friendly way. I think it would be useful for us, as standard setters, particularly the board, when you go to write a disclosure requirement, that you see what else is around that. We set disclosures on an individual standard basis, and I think we don't often step back and look at the bigger picture of what the whole package of disclosure is, and is there a way that we can bring that together and maybe view it from different perspectives than what it's currently set up in the standards themselves. So almost creating a disclosure standard, but doing that electronically through a different view rather than actually recreating it through the standards.
On this, we discussed about 1 year ago. I feel doubt, you know, if we consider such a program as some kind of codification like Big Four firms manual, I will feel it is understandable. You know, we already established this whole requirement for individual standards. You know, then on that basis, we, you know, put them together, and Big Four firms often do so. But to establish a totally new project, to have this endeavor, I feel doubt, you know.
I wasn't meaning it was going to be a standard, it was just a way to view what we already have. So I wouldn't expect it to change any of the requirements and any of the digital standards. It's collating all the disclosures
or a
together.
Tool for us
it's
internally.
A tool, internal
yes.
tool
yes.
for
so
us.
We know the context of the new disclosures.
It's not meant to be a standard or a...
You use the word standard.
I didn't
standardized, I think. Or
sorry if I used the standard. I didn't mean it to be a standard. I just said that what I meant was a way to see disclosures in one place. When you go to write a disclosure requirement, to be able to see what other disclosure requirements might relate or be similar to or already cover the topic that you're trying to create so that you don't repeat or we're consistent with.
All right. Slide 14 gets back to some questions that I deferred, so I promised we'd come back to those, and here we are. A couple of the issues about the drafting guide for us to talk about and discuss is that we view it as a living document, one that will be continuously updated and revised as we review existing standards, you know, depending on sort of how the scope of the project plays out as we write new standards, conduct internal research, participate in outreach, that we will have a feedback loop that will help us continue to improve it. This has ramifications for its kind of form and due process. It also, because it contains not just guidance or guidelines, but we view it as containing processes and technology, you know, sort of solution. But is this both living and containing these other things? This has implications for its form, which in turn then has implications for due process. At present, we recommend that its content should be made public without exposing it for comment. ASAP had a different view on that, and you know, we put that, you know, to all of you as well. Sue.
Mary,
okay.
A couple of reactions pulling together this and back to one or two points on slide 10. I'd caution against overplaying the living document.
Yep.
I mean,
okay.
Everything we do is subject to revision. And I think rather than saying continuously updated, maybe let's get a target for reviewing it after it has been used consistently several times. And I'm not worried about being overly prescriptive about what that target is, but rather than sending the message of it's changing every week
all the
or
time,
every month,
right. Sure.
Let's have three or four trials with it and see, you know, does it work, and then stand back and say, okay, what have we learned? What, you know, what would we do? Which leads me back on slide 10 to say, where you say finalize the drafting guide and then do the exposure draft. Maybe think about doing it the other way around. Having a trial run with a drafting guide, seeing if it helps us get through the process, and then coming back and saying, okay, then let's give this a 2 or 3 year run. And then back on slide 13, two things, one on processes. I think the a process point to put in there, kind of on the how we, you know, how we write, not how we draft, but how we think about disclosures, is some kind of tool for collecting thoughts along the way, rather than, you know, a last gasp and we do disclosures at the end. And then last, under the tools that would help with implementing guidelines and processes, I think we almost need a taxonomy here, so that, for example, and we should, you gave the example of business activity maturity analysis, use of synonyms. Mm-hmm. I think it's time to be dull in our drafting. You know, let's try to standardize the wording we use for certain things rather than vary it. I think the translators of the world will bless us. Yeah. But also to think about things like, if our objective is information about liquidity, then our tools are X, and be consistent in referring to it, so that we could, for example, tag all the places where we ask for information about liquidity. Think about shifting the sequencing, trying to stabilize this a bit more without saying it's set in concrete and we can't change anything about it, and testing it a bit more. I'm fine with the idea of not formally exposing it for comment, but maybe giving a chance for informal comment as, you know, in the first phase, and then as we reflect on the experience after several years with it.
I agree with what the Mary said, and this is a really important issue in the future. So if the technology evolves, then everything would be possible. So in the extreme case, if the company can disclose each single entry of general ledger or each single transaction data, mm-hmm. then if the technology evolves, user can pick up any information they like to meet their purpose. That's the extreme case. But the question is, what's the accounting standard is all about? So accounting standard is somehow objective related opinion. That is my view. So there is an objective of the disclosure, or there is an objective of the standard. Then the preparer and the auditors make a judgment and that, you know, explain what it's all about with their own view. That is kind of the purpose of the accounting standard, so that the user can know what's the intention of the preparers, what's the intention of the issuers, and they make their own judgment. So such kind of communication is the kind of accounting standard. However, if we pursue this route, then what we require is to just disclose the fact only, without any judgment, and then the user would judge. So that's the extreme case. Somehow we need such kind of data process in 50 years time or something. However, we are in the middle. So this initiative is very important. What is our position and what is the objective? What kind of judgment can the preparer make? And the problem of the accuracy is very problematic. I mean, if you put yourself in the shoe of preparers, mm-hmm. what they worry about is the how should we accurate? To what extent we should be accurate? That is very important issue, especially when you discuss with the auditors. Mm-hmm. So then, if the objective is to get the rough idea, then the accuracy itself is not very important. So in that case, you know, giving a rough idea with opinion and judgment will do, and goes a long way, and the user would appreciate. So in that case, you don't need to look at each in detail. So we discussed it in the materiality issue. So So, but not only just materiality, but also the accuracy issue would be important when you go down this path. So we can discuss it in the future.
And I just wanted to comment on this idea of whether it should be made public and the question of due process. I'm a big supporter of transparency and also due process, but I guess in this case I question the benefit of making something like this public. Not because I think it's secret or anything, I just wonder what the benefit is for us or for people outside the building. Firstly, it will mean that we'll have to then spend time polishing it and making it beautiful for public exposure rather than getting on with improving our drafting. But also, they're going to see in the way that we approach, hopefully, our disclosure discussions and board papers, our approach, what we're aiming for, what we're looking at in terms of consistency, style, how we're building in the justification for when things should be disclosed or not. They're going to see in the basis for conclusions, the justification for the way we've done things. They're going to get an opportunity to comment on whether they like the way that we've drafted it and if they think it's going to get a good result in their view on consistency with other things. So they don't lose anything in terms of their ability to comment or add to the process.
Yeah.
And I just wonder what the benefit is for them of seeing this document, or for us, because I feel like we lose some flexibility. And it's not that I want it to be a secret, but I'm not sure that the benefits really justify taking that flexibility.
Thank you. I agree with Sue's and Gary's, and I prefer some kind of exposure of the drafting guide to get a lot of feedback from our constituents.
That's what Sue said.
Gary,
yeah.
Also in the beginning.
Yeah,
yeah, right. So I agree with these two opinions. I think, you know, many national standards might have some experience with this kind of drafting guide when they developed their own standard maybe long before. If they have such kind of good experience, then we can share with us the how to make this drafting guide is very useful. So that's why I'm suggesting. I'm agreeing with these two guys. And another thing is maybe this drafting guide, the advantage of this, the benefits of this drafting guide might have maybe other things to do. And I mean, there are maybe other benefits in addition to reduce their disclosure overload. For example, some kind of a consistent application of note disclosure requirements, because we are dealing with some expression issues and many things. So there are many, many advantages. So that's why I'm suggesting maybe not to your team, maybe to Hugh, maybe we can develop another drafting guide for the general IFRS writing, the body of IFRS. There are inconsistencies, all kinds of expressions, structure, contents are different among their many IFRSs. That might cause some kind of an inconsistent application of IFRS. So there are many things to do by us to improve this kind of consistency in interpretation and the translation and finally the application. So I really strongly recommend to you, you know, to think about some kind of a basic drafting guide to write to develop each IFRS, because even among the recently developed IFRS, maybe 13, 14, 15, 16 of IFRS, they might have some kind of different structure, different organization, different expressions, even those new standards. So this might cause our stakeholders or constituents to apply very inconsistently. So we can improve the consistency. So I guess this drafting guide is a very, very good idea, you know. So this will help our constituent to apply IFRS disclosure. And also, as I said before, there are really good advantages. So that's what I'm suggesting.
As I understand it, it was a drafting guide for us, not for our constituents.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I understand. But for us, if there are many teams are writing some kind of a different standards, but these different teams are sometimes they are coordinated with a kind of a good format among us. However, sometimes they are very different. in writing the, our requirements. So this drafting guide might give a, some at a minimum some kind of standardization when we write our staff members write.
That's internal, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose the benefit is.
Yes, as a benefit.
Daryl.
So I kind of agree with some of what Chung Wu was saying, that I think that it does provide a very useful starting point for getting our language the same, for using consistent language and the like. I think starting this in the space of disclosures makes a lot of sense, because that's a very specific issue that we're trying to deal with. I agree very strongly with what Sue was saying earlier, and that I don't think we should be trying to put this out into the bigger world. And in part, I think it's because I slightly disagree with Mary. I think as we work through the process, this is going to be perhaps not a living document, but there are going to be iterations to the document. And I think the difficulty for us is this is a little bit of a learning experience for us in applying this. It's a process. The last thing we need to deal with, I think, is people not looking at disclosure in the context of the standard we've produced it, but trying to look at disclosure to see whether we've met the objective we set ourselves previously. I think we need to be explaining disclosure in the context of each of those standards, and if we're improving the process, we'll hear quickly enough back that we're improving the process, and if we're not, we'll hear that quickly enough. So I think it's almost a distraction to put this out into the public. I think it's useful for us internally. And the other point that I think Sue made that I agree with very strongly is I think anything we put out into the public does have to go through a lot more process than something that we simply use as an internal structure to help us understand things. And then to Chung Wu's point, I think once we've got this, if this is actually working for us, I think there is merit in looking beyond just disclosure to see if we're using the same words in the same places.
One suggestion that Hugh made actually at the ASAF meeting when there was a discussion about the consistency of terms, which I thought was a good one, was making making sure we have a specific question and exposure drafts about particular language and whether people think it's a consistent use with other places and things like that. Mm-hmm. So one thing to Chung Wu's point about getting input would be to be careful when we're drafting questions and exposure drafts to make sure that we're including questions that hone in on the way that we've drafted the disclosure requirements, because that would be a way of focusing on that without having sort of a separate disclosure drafting guide type document that we're necessarily getting public input on, but we'd get input in the process that way, but targeted. So I thought that was a good way of doing that.
Yes, we can move on to, why don't we move on to the questions? Though, actually, I did promise.
As usual, we discussed all the questions already.
Though, if I could just briefly draw our attention to, you know, some version, either look at slide 16 or 17, because one of the things we're proposing is that we have an initial phase where we do the guide, test it, kind of settle in on some version of the guide that seems stable, and then what to do next. And so the what next is goes to the point of Ian's question about what are we saying to the market about, are we reviewing all the standards, are we cutting, and Sue's points. And we've heard those as well, that the expectation is that we review every single standard and we're just cutting. And what we're saying is we could, proposing is an initial phase where we look at either specific issues, specific standards, kind of get done with that, and then there's a decision point perhaps for the board to make then about how we proceed. Do we go through every single standard? Do we review, you know, just from this list of four, do we move on to the rest of the four? Are there new targeted issues that come up? Are there new standards? So question for you is, you know, what do you think about doing this in two phases, if you will, have an initial phase and then a decision point once we see how that is gone, and, you know, that will sort of answer our messaging to our stakeholders about what we're doing. Right now we're doing the initial phase and it consists of this, and then when we're done with that, the board will discuss again and decide. So shall we move on to the questions then in 18?
No, you finish.
Okay. I think slide 16 then just gives you examples of all the things we could do at that decision point. And you know, it's really focused only on new standards, review current only when reopened for any reason, such as in post-implementation reviews, review the remaining or new ones that were on our target list, if we've added new ones, additional drafting issues that maybe have surfaced as we've gone through the initial phase, or any combination of the above. Slide 17 is the big picture. And the initial phase is complete, when, you know, in our mind, when we have a final amendments to the general stand to IAS 1 that are the result of the principles of disclosure discussion paper, or a new general disclosure standard. And we've also finalized any amendments to standards that have come through the initial phase of the review. And then we have the decision point for what to do beyond that.
So what is the bottom box on the left? Proposed amendments to disclosure requirements where?
That would be any of the, whether we decided to, you decided to target a standard and have us go through and develop the drafting guide and develop proposed amendments based on the drafting guide or specific issues, target issues. So it's that first pass, the initial phase should result in some proposed amendments to standards. And it will depend on whether we take the targeted standard approach, targeted issue approach.
That's where we have to be careful with the messaging. Because on one hand, we're saying we haven't made up our mind whether we're going to fiddle with standards. On the other hand, we're saying, but we will fiddle with some as we go through. So it's kind of a mixed message.
Well, I think there's two stages. So if we go back to slide 11, we're saying on the initial phase, as we draft, create this drafting guide, we'd like to test it on something. And we want a decision about what we should test it on. Is it a particular standard, couple of standards, protected issue, nothing? I mean, and then once we've done that, then I think there's another decision point. What do we do going forward? Do we do some more standards? Do we say, actually, we'll just look forward?
Yeah, or but the point I missed on slide 11, I suppose it's there quite clearly, that we will, as in the first phase, actually change some standards.
Yep.
Yeah, that's the question.
Well, no, that's what's said here. And then the decision point comes after that. Will we look at more standards? So we just have to carefully get that message that people understand we are going to fiddle with standards in the first phase.
Right, okay.
So I don't understand. So we do all this, we have a drafting guide, then we're going to first fiddle with one standard, and then we look if we are going to fiddle with all, and I don't understand.
I think they're saying as we do the first phase, we're going to have to look at some standards to test out.
Okay, but that doesn't mean necessarily changing them. That's
no,
that will identify whether there are problems or not,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
That's
and that was the bit that I missed on what we're actually going to do in the first phase.
Okay.
You need the standards to inform what you're doing.
Yeah.
But Hans' point still remains that we don't have to go the next step of actually changing this.
No, although I would be very surprised if the outcome of all this work would be that everything is hunky-dory.
Right.
Very much right. And then it would be very confusing if we didn't make sense.
Yeah, so come on. Let's be serious. Gary?
I don't know if this is off slide 18 or 17, but just a general observation. Is, you know, I really support this whole initiative, is but we could have the world's best written drafting guidelines, but I think we should be honest with ourselves. As you go through board deliberations, I mean, every subset of every project seems to get its own disclosure requirement, and this can be the best written guideline ever written. It's not going to change individual technical decisions at the board table. Or staff recommendations, disclose this, disclose this, disclose this. Granted, it'll have the overarching if presumed if material, but you know, but this whole phenomena is part of the reason why we're here, because it should be if material, but doesn't operate that way in practice at the minimum. So I think we just need to be cautious or self-reflective that this won't solve, you know, technical decision making.
I mean, you're talking about I guess more the what.
We have a drafting guideline to draft how do we write disclosures, but hard review, disclosure overload, too many details. This doesn't solve that. What I think could help is focusing more on the objectives. It of what disclosure should be, then, you know, and then, and you work from there. And I would, I'll give credit where it's due, because Martin's not here. He raised it first, at least in my presence, but I agreed. It seems like when you kind of put how much time you spent in technical deliberations, disclosures always seems almost like an afterthought on the last day of the project. We're doing, and, you know, maybe it needs more attention during the project or more time in there. And I would suggest, if we're going to come up with objectives for disclosures, we'd should get through the recognition and measurement and stuff. Then we have its own session on objectives of disclosures. Then the staff comes back with the disclosures. I mean, I think that needs more attention than perhaps we're even acknowledging sitting here today.
If I can respond to that. I think the guidelines are going to have more than just how to write it. One of the slides talks about having the content, the processes, and the last part. So the process would involve like the technical process of standard setting. So the guidelines would be a little more than how to write standards. Will involve like when should the board and the staff engage in talking about the objectives, as you said, and the disclosures.
Well, I hope so. I mean, we didn't really quite touch on that in here, but I would hope so. But again, to me, the clear objectives and how we formulate objectives project by project are actually more important than, you know, how to write the disclosures, because that'll work itself out, you know.
Yeah, I think we hope or hopeful, and the intent is that it's more than a writing style guide, that it is sort of really a new approach or an improved approach to writing disclosure requirements that includes the processes around when we do it, who's involved, making sure the disclosure objectives are written clearly and defined clearly, specific enough. As we've talked about, just having a high-level disclosure objective doesn't really solve, perhaps, what we would like to solve in this project. So,
Stephen.
How does the work of the New Zealand standard setter fit into all of this? Because it seems to me that they've already redrafted two standards, and they have done so with an implicit drafting guide.
Yeah. It's a limited drafting guide, and I would say it's a section in the discussion principal disclosure discussion paper, and it's there on purpose because it allows us to get some feedback around at least probably two things. One is the approach that they reflected in their section on how to write objectives for two specific standards. So, you know, people can comment on, we think these objectives are well written or not, or helpful or not. So that's one piece of it. And then sort of redrafting, trying to pull out the overly prescriptive language that people can actually comment on, that whether that seems to have solved something or not. So it's in a section in the discussion paper on purpose to get people's reactions to both the way to the approach to objectives, as well as just sort of a way of writing that maybe avoids overly prescriptive. And it opens the door to commentary and feedback that says, actually, you need prescription here. And so don't write it that way. Don't make a drafting guide contain this sort of way of writing. We need prescription subject to materiality.
I think it feeds directly in, and that's why we've said that the POD discussion paper feeds into the drafting guide, and the responses we get from that effectively build on. And as you say, it's implicitly that there's drafting guides within what they've done. So that's why we've sort of said that we would develop from the POD using the feedback. We're making sure that we specifically try and make it clear that that's what the feedback on that section is going to do.
I think it's a valid challenge, though, and it comes back to the messaging point that you were saying. It's all we've got so many threads going, mm-hmm. we risk confusing people, so mm-hmm. we've got to be on message with the message. Okay. On mark with the message, whatever.
On message with the message. Yeah.
Mary.
A few thoughts. If I look at slide 16, I have some specific reactions, but it makes me go back and think about the process and Hans's point about testing it, but does, you know, the fact that we come up with, here's what it would look like if we were applying it, does that mean we actually have to follow through and change the disclosure requirements? In other contexts, we have had discussions about too much change to our standards, lack of a stable platform, et cetera, which drives me to say focusing on new standards or standards that are open for other reasons rather than saying let's send a message that we plan to do a front-to-back review of all the disclosure requirements and all of our standards, you know, solely to align. Second thought is before we have a before we set a target of let's get all new ones and then as we look at old ones updated to the new standard, you know, to the, this is like your on message messaging, to, you know, to the new template thinking, etc. I think we do need to actually make the changes and then have those changes applied for a couple of years and have people get used to them and then get the feedback from that before we say, okay, this works or good try, but let's not change everything. And when you think about what that involves, we're probably talking 4 or 5 years, sad as it is, because it's us doing the revision, putting it out, letting people, you know, giving people the normal 18, 24 months to adopt, and then having them do it for a couple of cycles before standing back and saying, yes, you know, you've really hit the mark, or we found it difficult to, you know, to get this to work, or there's lots of discussions about what X means. And so I'd say a very limited, I would say tend to a very limited population in the early years, focus mostly on standards that are new rather than trying to do overhauls, and think about that testing. I do think there's nothing like actually using it rather than saying, well, what do you think if we were to do it this way? So the New Zealand work on PP&E, we won't get the same level of tested in anger that, you know, how does it really work if people are just looking at it, well, this is what it would look like if we did it this way, but we're going to stick with the current disclosures and not road test this anywhere until we, you know. So let's find a test case that makes sense in terms of stability of the platform. Let's test it, get the feedback before we roll it out widely, which leads me to say focusing on new standards or standards and current standards only when reopened for other reasons rather than changing the disclosure requirements of all standards so we have a new version of every standard that we have.
It's always depressing when you hear people saying yes, but I do agree that it needs to be a somewhat measured approach because we need to see how it unfolds. And I just know that during the crisis when people weren't providing information on forbearance, how many conversations I had with people about what the disclosure objectives were in IFRS 7, which I know aren't perfect, but they are our early attempts at being objective-based, and they just said, it doesn't say I have to.
Mm.
And that just makes me nervous, because I think if we take things away, getting them back ever again is going to be well nigh impossible. So we just need to be measured, I think. Having said that, I think we do need to be careful not to suddenly send out a message we're revamping every disclosure requirement in IFRS, not least because it's going to come with costs, even if we hope it comes with benefits, and so it's not necessarily going to thrill everybody. Where I think we do have some good opportunities in the near term, though, maybe to do quite a targeted look at existing requirements and what might not be working with a view to trying to apply some of the new ideas would be in a couple of the post-implementation reviews that we've got starting next year. So that's going to include IFRS 12, which is a well-hated standard from a disclosure requirement perspective, and also IFRS 13, which has got a lot of disclosures in it, and also the FASB have just been overhauling their disclosure requirements, so we can have a look at what comes back. And I think it would be good as part of that PIR to really think carefully about targeted questions we can ask on the disclosure piece that would give us information that would help us in this project. Because I think with a few of the standards that are very disclosure heavy, if we've got an opportunity where they're open and we're targeted, that could be we could get some early wins.
One of the pieces of feedback we got from the project manager of the FASB project that was interesting was that if you go into a standard that has controversy accounting at all, and you're saying we're just looking at disclosure, people immediately move to the controversy accounting. And so he gave that as a key cautionary tale that they ran into, so that may point in the direction of look at ones that are open.
Yep.
for other reasons that, that include the accounting. Okay. So let's talk the, through the questions and
again.
Okay. So let's make sure that
anything you could, we haven't discussed yet.
Yes. I mean, more. Look, let's make sure we haven't missed anything. I guess maybe three. Are you all agreed with the approach of not making it public? Because three, as written, is make it public but not expose for comment.
Let's keep it secret.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Rather than it's a secret. Rather than it's revealed in our normal processes.
It's revealed in over the process of actually writing disclosure requirements for standards.
I'm not so
question
sure about
three. Question three, first part.
Yes.
Do you agree with the proposed draft guidance content? I don't see clearly the principle.
I think it's the sort of the overarching ideas of that the content will be guidelines for writing, processes, and tools to help us actually write better.
Steve.
So it's guidelines, processes, and tools, I think, is what you're saying. Yes, we agree that, that all of that should be in the drafting guide.
Steve's got his card.
Anyway, but here the proposal is to make it public, so not keep it secret, but not exposing it for comment.
That's part two. There's two parts to that question, and so I think you want to be sure about what is contained in part one, and then the other question is part two.
So are we agreeing with the recommendation to make the final draft public?
Yeah.
Drafting.
That I would agree with.
Yeah. Make it public.
And what about discussing it with ASAP?
That is. Well, I think we should do that.
But then, doesn't it become public?
Well, but even more basically, Steve, if we discuss it at the board, as we are today.
Well, effectively, we're going to be discussing the content.
But exposing it for public.
Oh, yeah, no, that exposure is different, but it will be public.
Yes,
it will unless be public. We do it in admin meetings.
And effectively, a draft will be public if.
Yeah, and if people want us to want to write us a letter, nobody can stop them. That's
okay, I didn't want it to remain.
But then, are we
secret?
Committing that what was shown at the board meeting is now exactly the document, and we haven't made any changes to it? Because I think.
Yeah, I agree with that.
What does public mean? I mean, it's one thing having aired the general content; the other is, are you constantly going to update it and show it every word change? I mean, I don't mind it being in a board paper, but that's different to having like the formal document on our website, for example.
Yeah, I'm not sure you'd necessarily want, unless we are posting the whole document as a whole, I'm not sure you'd necessarily have all of it in the board papers. You might have extracts or you might have the things that flow from it, but you wouldn't necessarily have the document itself.
I'm not sure what the purpose is of keeping it secret, and I'm nervous about the world thinking, oh, there's this secret document.
Well, it will not be secret.
It's not that formal. That's the only point I'm trying to make.
I a question regarding the, we don't intend to put it in the due process handbook, right? It's not part of the due process.
That's a question.
No, okay, that's fine. I want to make sure.
I'm sorry.
No, I raise the question because once we have a document, we must have a repository somewhere. So we have various boxes where we put our documents. When is the due process handbook?
That's exactly what I'm trying to avoid. What sort of formality does
so there will be no special place where to put it. I would say it's a traditional filing of
documents.
Amaru? Just to make clear, as I was understanding, if it's a document that we are going to use to develop standards, and I see no problem at all in leaving it to the public knowledge. So I agree with Steve on this. I do not expect us to expose it, the due process for comment and everything. But it's a document that can be.
But that's the proposal.
Yeah. But there's divergence in here.
Yeah.
So
everybody wants it to be public.
Okay.
The only question is, do we expose it?
I think there was I don't mind it being attached to a board paper, but I don't then want to have to commit that. You know, that's the exact document we're using internally, and we have to always map back to justify that we've applied that document as written.
And I think that's my concern. I do think this is going to be a developing document that we change on an ongoing basis. If we say that this is now a public document, it suggests that every time we update it, we presumably have to publish the new updated version, and does that in turn mean we have to explain why we updated and what the changes were?
And if people object to the change we've made, how do we deal with the objections they make to the... I think we've got to be careful of almost overdue processing something that's just meant to help us.
Isn't the FASB's equivalent going to be part of their conceptual framework?
Yes.
It seems odd that they should have it, do it that way, and we should have a document that's then not public.
But I think this would be more detailed probably than you'd expect to see in a conceptual framework. I mean, I think there is a case for making it public, but in a sort of more low-key way. And one thing I've long wanted to do is to get some more stuff on our website that will be useful reference material for the board. So an example I've got in mind is a paper that Joan Brown wrote about 4 or 5 years ago on cash flows, which I think has got some extremely good material in it. And I think it's very useful to the board and can be very useful to the board. And it would be helpful to have it kept there more visible than just sort of left buried in a board paper that was discussed 5 years ago. And we could do the same sort of thing with this. We could have it up on the website, we can consult it, we can refer to it, and when it needs updating, we can update it. So that might be worth thinking about.
I see no problem in doing that.
Okay.
And then I think maybe the last thing was question five was we proposed to include a description of our approach in the phases of the project within the principal's discussion disclosure paper. That also gives us a chance to have feedback and comments on that as we move forward. Yeah? Okay. Thank you.
I have one more comment to make about the project as a whole. I think for this project to be a success, we need to end this product. We need an extra product, I think, and I think the product should be practical educational material for preparers how to work with this. And I know we have this practice statement for materiality, but it's still rather high level, not extremely practical. I know that there are a lot of companies out there already who have gone through the process, even with the existing standards and the disclosure requirements, to make their disclosures more meaningful. And I do think that more meaningful disclosures usually means less. Cut out the less relevant disclosures. And John Perry has told us about a couple of companies in New Zealand who have gone through the process and really slimmed down and improved their disclosures. So I think what we should do at the end, but it could also be done during this process because it can also inform what we are trying to develop, is to create a document with some best practices before and after and how companies went about doing it. And I think such a document could give good guidance on how to use the possibilities that we have created or improved with the work that we are doing now. If we don't do something like that, I don't know if you would call it a practice statement or just educational material. I'm not sure if we'll get the maximum out of what we are doing and if people will really understand what we are trying to achieve. I don't know if it's a good idea, but that's what I've been brooding about. Philippe?
I think it's a very good idea. I support. Just don't try to start from a blank sheet of paper. A lot of people have been working on that. There is a lot of materials from securities regulators, from various preparers, and try to get the best from them. Don't try to start from zero.
Is this a silly idea, or is this something that could work? Or
no, I think it's an excellent idea.
We need a mechanism for bringing this all to life, and I think that's what it could.
And if it comes from us rather than from us, the standard setter, I think it will have more impact than just from a local regulator.
Yeah, if I can just mention, Dara might have the same experience in running education activities with the education team. I do it quite frequently in Latin America with Mike.
materiality and how to apply and disclosure, those are very frequent questions. It's almost all sessions, almost every aspect. So if we are able to develop some education material along these lines, I think would be excellent.
Hans, I agree with the idea, but how to do it, I think we can have two ways. The ways you suggested, I personally feel it may not be workable. It means in on top of the final products, we prepare another some kind of practice statement or guidance. I don't think it workable. Maybe another way I suggest, you know, after we finalize all those improved disclosure requirements, we solicit maybe the asset member countries to apply those new requirements, you know, use some industry or some entities, you know, to see whether, as you said, for example, HSBC formerly 800 now become 600 in some targeted area, they say yes, it's good, you know, based on the new requirements. I think maybe second way. The first way, I don't think it.
I don't understand what you propose.
But the, what do you suggest to have a practice statement?
I'm not sure how what form it should take.
More education. More like a case study.
You know, I have looked at financial statements of companies on websites where they also use electronic ways to get through to the disclosures in a very logical way, in which you don't have first have to wade through all these disclosures to get to the point. So I could even imagine that you might want to use electronic ways of demonstrating this. I'm open to any suggestions. I haven't really thought about it.
The case study type.
But we could do it more informal. If it's just the educational material, opens up possibilities to do it in a more informal way. But you know, I think it will be very helpful for preparers to look at some examples at how they could do it. Otherwise, these people will not do it.
Yeah, Hans, as I said, maybe case study type of ways.
Yeah,
to, you know, I think so. With the help from ESO members or big four firms.
Can I just play devil's advocate for a second? Just, I'm mindful of my prior life having been able to opine on how specific companies do things and have wildly opined on that and made trading decisions off of it, et cetera. But I'm sort of interested in, as a standard setter, opining on specific companies.
Well, you would anonymize it to begin with.
And sort of drawing it to, and is that something we do and have done?
We can take ourselves. We did this exercise on ourselves last year, actually.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you anonymize it and change the statements.
We
have to be careful of the limits of this exercise, because there is a danger if we opine on a specific case, then we are kind of sponsoring that entity. If there is any
problem,
we have to be careful of the limits. Yeah. But yeah. It doesn't mean we cannot do it if we just make sure we don't go too far.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.